Okay, folks, good afternoon. Apologies for the late start. Apologies to the Capetonians for the bit of interruption and interference on that side. We don't have to apologize to Joburg people. Before this meeting, there was an exchange of emails, and I made a review. Okay, and then Anthony said something like, that's probably all the introduction he needs, and I thought, you don't need an introduction. I mean, if you introduce Anthony Asher to the Actuarial Society of South Africa, you do this whole spiel, and people afterwards say, yes, I know that, but who the heck are you? So, in case there's anybody who doesn't know, Anthony is a fellow of the Actuarial Society of South Africa. He moved to Australia in 2003. He's held the view that the actuarial profession contributes to society by creating financial security for people. And throughout his career as an actuary, he's contributed through practicing in product development, making sure that the product matches the need of the client, drawing the attention of the profession through this to this approach through research and education, participation in various government and other investigations and initiatives. He served on the Council of the Actuarial Society. He was member of a disciplinary committee at the time these committees were appointed on an ad hoc basis. Served on the National Retirement Consultative Forum, was a member of the Taylor Commission into Social Security. excuse me. Like I said, he relocated to Australia in 2003, where he joined the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority. After that, he moved to a consulting company, and then since 2011, he was in South Africa. He was a lecturer at WITS for 14 years. So he's always had this burning desire to teach at a real university, and in 2011, they still couldn't find a position for him at Free State University, so he joined the University of New South Wales. His current research includes various issues around financial planning and a virtue theory approach to risk culture and overregulation. Anthony, I have polished you now. Please don't disappoint him again.
Many thanks, Ben. Thank you. I feel as though I really am singing for my song, my supper with this mic. Really nice to be here again. It's really great to be back in South Africa. There's a sort of, I feel very much at home, and I'm very much welcomed every time. And you know, some of the times I've been here, I thought, well, you know, have I really got something worth saying? But I've really said it anyway because I'd like to meet everyone. But this time I really do think I've got something I've got something by the tail. Whether I've got it right or not, and how wrong, how much it needs to be polished, I don't know. But I think it's quite important, but it's quite a big exercise. So bear with me. Well, no, work hard to stay with me because there's quite a lot to be said. And obviously it's a difficult question. Is greed good for business? Some people think so. Some people think not. I spent most of last year, a good deal of last year anyway, my research time last year, developing submissions to the Royal Commission on misconduct in the financial services in Australia. And part of the reason was that the commissioner actually said in his interim report, the problem is greed as the cause of all this misconduct. And I looked at it and I thought, well, we don't really know much about greed, or I haven't really thought much about greed. What does he mean? And I've spent ages, a lot, reading up and making up the gaps in my knowledge about greed over the ensuing year. So, my agenda. I'm going to try and persuade you that greed is exploitative and ask the question, is it motivating? Because if it is motivating, it then permits the exploitation or may justify the exploitation. I want to take us through both the personal and structural origins of our decisions, of our motivation. I want to suggest that greed is actually best understood as a distortion of personal motivation and a personal challenge. We look a little bit at alternative views from economics and from psychology and religion. Look at institutional market design, how that can help control greed and address it, and why institutional economic and regulatory challenges is a challenge to us to reform. And then some differences at the end to show where I come from that's different from what common views that you may have or share or think will come across. We've got enough time, so please interrupt briefly. Feel free to interrupt as I go along. I don't think we can hear you from Johannesburg, so you'll just have to SMS me. I've got my phone here, so you can do that to my Australian number, which you'll find on the web, seeing you've almost certainly got that facility. All right. Greed is exploitative. Is it motivating? So let me define greed as insatiable. Insatiable appetite. Cannot be satisfied, mainly for money, and that leads to, in particular, overpricing, overservicing, and sometimes recklessness. So I'm not saying that greed is self-interest is greed. Greed is beyond self-interest. Self-interest is given. We expect everyone to look after themselves, and if they don't, they're problems. But in a transaction, if one party uses collateral power, something unrelated to the transaction, to manipulate the outcome of a transaction, they can overcharge or overservice or in another situation be reckless. So the question is, a fair transaction, Margaret and I deal with each other, we both know exactly what we're dealing with, she pays me and I give her the service or the product or whatever it is, fine, fair. If she makes a profit, that's also fine. The problem is if in some way I am deceived, she doesn't tell me everything about it, she doesn't tell me everything about it, or I'm in fact forced to use her because I'm desperate for it. I offering the service? I force her to use it because she's desperate. She hasn't got other thoughts. She hasn't got time to look around. So in our economic terms, the consequence of greed is called economic rent. It's profits made that is not necessary to produce the goods. So I'm not against profit. For those of you who were in my honors classes, and I spent a lot of time teaching the fact that profit should be maximized and is maximized when marginal cost equals marginal revenue. It's important to get there. Beyond that is the problem. Okay, so it's overcharging, overservicing, and lawyers are worst at overservicing. Drag you into a court case that you don't want, but the doctors do it, actuaries do it. I mean, long reports and excessive number of pages. We can all overservice, give people more than they need. And then obviously in the GFC there was recklessness. Hi, we can see the Joburg people. You're all at the back. Oh, there we go. Hi. So, free and efficient markets require rules of the game that create transparency so that the parties can get what they really want, choice to transact or to walk away, and trust so that you not waste time checking on others. All three, particularly trust, are undermined if one party is greedy. Now, let me just say that the one example of this is taken from Douglas North, who's institutional economist. He compares the souk markets in the Middle East, S-U-Q. He looks at them, and he's there where you go to Cairo and you try and buy a Persian carpet, and you negotiate, okay? And the name of the game, the rules of the game are, the shopkeeper tries to get you to pay as much as possible, and you try to get the best bargain as possible, and you pay as little as possible. It's fun, all right? A big negotiation. But when you buy everything that way, it is extremely time-consuming. And if you're not really sussed, you get ripped off. In fact, North says that 50% of the cost of production is consumed by the negotiation for the price. Now, they compare that with you go into Woolies or Pick and Pay here, fixed price, no negotiation, you go in, you walk out, and they take a 10% profit margin or whatever they cost margin. You think, much more sensible. This must have evolved in the West and didn't do in the Middle East. Didn't evolve in the West. The Quakers took 200 years from the middle of the 17th to the middle of the 19th century to move markets into a situation where it was standard for prices to be fixed. And why did they do it? Because it was fair. Because, I mean, the Quakers are sort of a peripheral Christian religious group, but they're very strong on business. So you've heard of Quaker Oats and Cadbury's and Barclays and Roundtree, all Quaker companies. And the department stores in New York were the ones that started at fixed prices, so that the youngest child got the same deal as the wisest adult, or the savviest adult. Was it a fairness question? So really important. It is important to change institutions so that they are more efficient and more fair. But, okay, does greed motivate people to work harder and more creatively? To answer this, we must look more closely at motivation. Right, now is the difficult bit. A couple more before we get there. This is just a model. Personal motivation, institutional purpose. This is what motivates us internally. We've got our mental models, our emotions, as we'll come to, interactions with people. And then we create the institutions. Institutions exist because people change them. The institutions include cultures, norms, and logics, and there's power in an organization and regulation. And those institutions then socialize us to change our minds and to move us towards doing different things. So I'm not saying that motivation comes from one or the other, but some sort of interactive, complex arrangement. So, what motivates us? You all know Maslow. Sorry, it's a bit small here, but anyone not come across Maslow? 1943 paper, at the bottom, physiological needs, safety needs, going up, belonging, aesthetic, self-actualization, and transcendence. Those are the areas where, in order to live in the world, we have these needs. And if we look at the institutions that exist, so here are the needs on the left-hand column from Maslow, the institutions that exist, as the sociologists would say it, to be created to meet those needs. And we have to have them. Family, firms, departments of justice and defense, schools, universities, religious institutions. Not everyone belongs directly to one of those, but they have sort of different forms in different places. So, personal needs, institutions, that makes sense. Now, this is really fun. That's pretty old. 1943, the sociological institutions have been around for a century, probably. This is new. 2017. Dopamine. So what they say, what this neuroscientist said, they look into your brain and they can measure this, what hormones are being generated and which parts of your brain are activated and what's activating them and how they merge together. And this paper by Chieto and her colleagues pulls it all together and says, actually, what really seems to be happening is you've got what they call the dopaminergic reward system that drives us to want. That's the wanting hormone and the wanting system in our bodies, minds, that creates some sort of enthusiasm. And then it branches out to different satisfactions. So dopamine drives us to want. The satisfactions are what we like. There's actually a gap between the two, is what they have discovered. Now, we go back, I think a lot of people have read that for many years, but this is now confirmed by this. And what they've got at the top is what they say, a family tree of discrete positive emotions. So the positive emotions, pride is associated with the hormone, the generation of hormone serotonin. sexual desire with testosterone, love and contentment with oxytocin, awe and amusement, play and religion with the cannabinoids and the opioids, attachment, love and gratitude and opioids. So these different hormones create a different set of satisfactions. Interesting. Now, we can actually map them, and this is where this is why I think I'm onto something, because I think it actually it sort of fits together. So we've got here the dopaminergic appetites that actually match the needs. So because we have the needs, we necessarily need to have something to drive us to meet the needs. And in fact, I was reading today, they tried to breed rats. They managed to breed rats and to drug them so they had dopamine. And drugs with no dopamine don't even eat. They starve to death. Dopamine is what drives us to want. So we have all those things, hunger, libido, curiosity, desire for identity and autonomy, etc. And although there's only one sort of set of drivers, there are different rewards. And we've got cannabinoids, serotonin, testosterone, oxytocin, opioids. So these different hormones satisfy different needs. I can see that there's some consequences for how we are motivated, and how we are best find psychological personal health. And if that wasn't exciting enough, I've then been working for some years on this question of the virtues, which come back from Aquinas. So Thomas Aquinas, 1400 odd, the major theologian of the Middle Ages, developed this the set of virtues, which he took partly from the Greeks, so the four cardinal virtues from the Greek philosophers, going back to the Greek philosophers, which are justice, courage, wisdom, self-control, those four. And then he added faith, hope, and love from St. Paul. Now, they fit actually in fairly well, although and humility and integrity, which Aquinas hadn't got as one of the in the seven, but he did have them as virtues, as mentioned in his Summa Theologicae. But because the magic number in the Middle Ages was seven, the Greeks had the magic number of four virtues, and Aquinas had to have seven, so that's how it worked out. But when you put them, they fit quite well. So obviously, wisdom means cognition. Self-control means these psychological virtues. And in relationship, we want justice that everyone gets a fair share, and love that sort of builds us together. So go back another 800 years, and we get Evagrius Ponticus, who my wife and I discovered a couple of years ago, and Evagrius was Archdeacon of Constantinople in 390. And he got involved with a married woman for some reason or other and had to flee to the Egyptian desert where he became a monk. But being an educated man, he wrote a lot and sort of wrote up what the monks were believing. And he came up with the seven deadly sins. Well, what he called them, he didn't call them the deadly sins, he called them logismoi, or passions. And they, I've added and subtracted a little bit from them to get to that list, but they fit again quite well. And of course, why I sort of thought about him initially was that greed is one of his seven temptations. So greed, gluttony, lust, three of his temptations, but you remember these guys were in the desert and they were living on bread and nothing else. So those physical things counted quite a lot to them. Envy and anger relating to relationships, arrogance, pride that he had. He had a couple of cynicism, I think, is what he called it, acedia, which doesn't get translated very easily from the Greek. I think it's cynicism, that you basically don't believe in good. And then in courage he had despair or sorrow. But greed actually comes up everywhere. But so here were these temptations. So his point was, how do we work out what undermines the virtues? didn't have the seven virtues at that stage. So he just said, what undermines the vocation, the life of a monk? These are the things that do it. But in fact, they undermine all our healthy appetites and the meeting of the healthy appetites. And finally, on the score, Shioto, we're talking about the positive emotions. So these are the ones in the third column. But they're also negative emotions. And they're apparently, reading that they're more negative emotions than positive ones, but there's certainly enough there. That, the challenges are pain. Anomie at the top is a thing from the sociologists. It's a sort of type of despair. It's Emile Durkheim, last 2 centuries ago now, looked at anomie and as a cause of suicide, as sort of a loss of meaning. Confusion in intellectual, humiliation and guilt and esteem. A lot of people are really burdened, not necessarily by humiliation, but by feeling that they're guilty and so lose their feeling of identity and integrity. Sadness, indignation. Now, to an extent, that's the pattern. To an extent, I think this row, the safety row, and the challenges are linked, because although dopamine is a driver for the positive emotions, I think fear is actually is separate from dopamine. Adrenaline is separate from dopamine. So I think when you talk about greed and fear of being the two drivers of human behavior, that is partly true. So that would be dopamine and adrenaline, or noradrenaline or whatever. And the question of addressing fear is quite important in motivation. People can actually acquire money because of fear as well. But, so my major story, and as you can see, it's quite complicated. But I think as I was doing it, I thought, oh, this fits in quite well. I mean, I do find, moving things around a little bit. But it's intended as a mind map, an interdisciplinary mind map. So if we go to look at greed, we can't just look at one part of life. We've got to sort of step back and see what's going on. So this is an opportunity to step and say, okay, what's the big picture? And that, I think, is at least a start to sort of pull together the big picture of our motivation. So now the question is, what are the consequences? Anyone want to make any comments, questions at this point? All right, so that your attention is mounting. So other psychological insights from the psychoanalysts, a branch of psychology, Freud and Jung and whatnot were sort of psychoanalysts, they criticize very often for not having a particularly scientific approach and for being lacking in objectivity. But their advantage is they actually deal with people. People go to them for treatment. So they actually try and diagnose what the problems are, and they're able to provide treatment and bring people out of mental illness of various sorts, despair, depression, whatever. And they'll tell you that they do come across people that are addicted to greed. Now, this is the point, if you go back to the sort of the question of dopamine, you can actually get addicted to dopamine. It is, in fact, the source of addiction. So addiction to drugs, alcohol, sex, money is because gambling being the obvious thing. People are desperate, wanting these things, even though they offer no satisfaction. And this is the sort of contradiction and but they're addicted to the dopamine. Not to the satisfaction, to the dopamine. So Nicolai describes a client that he had, exploitative, self-serving, lacking in empathy, entertaining unrealistic expectations of entitlement without assuming reciprocal responsibilities. A disintegrated personality who's just addicted to wanting more. I think he was an estate agent, this particular guy, but you can see that might be a situation of where you might get addicted to greed. So they say the causes go back to inappropriate response to weaning. Your mother wasn't gentle enough when she took you off her breast. And uncertain childhoods. Now you might say, well, this is a little unscientific, and to an extent it is, but it is actually the accumulation of a lot of experience of individuals, and they've identified this as a problem. And I think it comes back to the question of, well, okay, it ties in with the question that one of the antidotes to greed is love. In fact, if they spray your nostrils with oxytocin before you do these dictator games that the economists play with, you become less selfish. So the dictator games, you're given money and you've got to decide how much you're going to give to someone else. Or there's an ultimatum game whereby if you give it to the other person, you only get it if the other person accepts. And so they can do these same experiments over many, many people. And oxytocin is the hormone that relates to cuddly type of love, nurturing love, and it makes you more gentle. So we are very much, we are both chemical and otherwise. So, and then the other type of work that psychologists have done is to do, various research as to whether greed is related to materialism and self-interest and miserliness, and it is, but they are distinct concepts. So you can be a miser without being greedy. In other words, you don't spend. You don't spend, but you may not be greedy, and etc. You might be materialistic and still greedy, or not greedy, and because you might measure everything in terms of materialism. And this thing about fear, not just greed. Right. Now, at this stage, sorry, I didn't bring it out. This is my sermon, but I need to sort of at least, the sermon part of this talk, but I need at least to say something to sort of explain to those of you that might find it, if you find it difficult for me to preach in the middle of a lecture or a sermon. So this is from David White, who's a poet that I enjoy a lot. So he says, and I'm going to be talking, as you see, about love. He says, "It doesn't interest me if there is one God or many gods. I want to know if you belong or feel abandoned. If you know despair or can see it in others. I want to know if you are prepared to live in the world with its harsh need to change you. If you can look back with firm eyes, saying, 'This is where I stand.' I want to know if you know how to melt into that fierce heat of living, falling towards the center of your longing." To repeat that, I want to know if you know how to melt into that fierce heat of living, falling towards the center of your longing. I want to know if you're willing to live day by day with the consequence of love and the bitter, unwanted passion of sure defeat. I have been told in that fierce embrace, even the gods speak of God. The unwanted passion of sure defeat. And the point is what I think he's got and what is inherent in much good literature, really good literature, stuff that moves us, is the question of desire. What do we want? And what we want is really central to who we are. So I'm going to take the Christian view of want, and you can use it to apply to whatever your religious or non-religious position is. So here is the Ten Commandments. Here are the Ten Commandments, which Jewish as well, Jewish and I think the Muslims accept it as well. Now, you've got to understand a lot of ancient literature, you've got to understand that much of it is chiastic, which means it circles round. Literature that was passed on orally needs a different type of memorizing to literature that's written. So literature that's written, you can go A, B, C, D, consequence D. Very much of ancient literature, from Homer through the Bible through to the Quran, apparently, goes not like ABCD, but ABCD CBA. It comes back to where it started. And that's, you can see, it's part of, if you're going to remember something, it's easier to remember under those circumstances. So the Ten Commandments are interesting on this score. So there they are. And what you see is, you should have no idols. Make no idols. You should not covet. You should love God. You should not love things. And interesting, honor God's name, which is related to speaking. No lying, related to speaking. Honor the Sabbath, which means you earn less money. No stealing, which means you don't, you know, you're getting more money. Honor your parents. No adultery. Family questions. Leading to the center, which is very often the important part of a set of commandments, which is do not murder. Being effectively respect the lives of others. And that can be, as certainly Christian and Jewish scholars would say, not murdering is much more important than just the actual act of slaughtering. So, now that throws a whole lot of light on a number of otherwise relatively puzzling things in the New Testament. So Paul says in Timothy, the love of money is the root of all evil, which translators don't like and very often translated as is the root of all sorts of evil. But actually, that comes from the Hindu Mahabharata about 3rd century BC. And apparently is also in a lot of Greek writings of about that time, the 3rd century. So Paul is actually commenting on, is bringing this from common saying. So you can say, okay, so the love of money is widely recognized as the root of all evil. And it's also one of the three poisons in Buddhism. And Paul also talks about covetousness, which is idolatry, which means he actually did have this association in his head. Jesus says, you cannot serve love and money. So the spiritual view of greed is actually it's misplaced love. It's a you've got your desire and you're desiring, as C.S. Lewis says, too little rather than too much. And the question is, what is really required, the solution to greed from the spiritual perspective, how do you get from the temptations and the control of your different appetites? You need to love God so that it puts them all into their appropriate place. Seek ye first, when Jesus, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which deals with the Ten Commandments, Jesus sums it up, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things will be added to you. So, the wisdom of the ages suggests that actually this greed is a misplaced love. We need to reorientate our lives. And if not, I'm suggesting that it starts there. But basically, we need to balance all these positive emotions and positive hormones to be fully healthy individuals. And we know that, don't we? It's a balanced life, family, self-esteem, appropriate relationships, security, time to think, as well as the sort of, you know, housing and food and clothing and all these things. So this is the trouble, all right? Neoliberal economics, which is sometimes referred to as standard economic theory. In the paper, I quote Daniel Kahneman as saying, standard economic theory is unusual in that it doesn't deal with justice. And I asked one of my colleagues at UNSW from the economics department to comment on my paper. And he said, you make me laugh. Daniel Kahneman isn't an expert in economics. But he won the Nobel Prize for economics. Surely I could quote him as someone who talks about it. But what is interesting, they talk about standard economics. Now, what would happen to you if I said standard actuarial theory? When we were having an argument, I said, standard actuarial theory is this, you're wrong. It's it's emotional. Okay, it's got no, there's no logical argument to talk about standard actuarial theory or standard economics or mainstream economics. Who says it's mainstream? Well, the people who think that way are mainstream. Actually, what has happened? After the war, a number of economists, less than 50, got together in the Mount Pelerin Society. There are Americans and Austrians, von Hayek, Friedman, a guy called Director, and a number of others from Mises, got together to form the Mount Pelerin Society with the objective of moving economic thought and political thought away from the collectivism of the early part of the communism and the collectivism of welfare economics, etc., that they thought was a risk to freedom. And they operated on the basis, they redefined monopoly, they redefined what liberal is, can be called neoliberal economics, and they changed the way they made markets synonymous with freedom. Now, you might say this is conspiracy theory. It's not conspiracy theory because they themselves, that's what they said. You can read their papers and the books about them where they shared their papers with people. 50 people changed the world, and we got Reagan and Thatcher and neoliberal economics, the economics that basically said, everyone is self-motivated, self-interested, greedy, and therefore the economy needs to be adjusted so that we align self-interest with the interests of the shareholders. Now, that's a legitimate theory on its own, but it's not standard. Most economists don't believe it, in my experience. But even if they do, it's still not universally believed, and it doesn't tie up with this multiple set of motivations. They effectively blank out all those things, and I think that's quite important to grasp. There's a political argument about neoliberal economics, and not actually an intellectual one. Sorry, just a few quick observations on mental illness. Which come from the table. So dysfunction. There's a debate within psychology about whether dysfunction is cognitive, whether it's mental illness is cognitive, whether it's emotional, or whether it has chemical causes. I think what the table says is all irrelevant. It's important to deal with the challenges of guilt and indignation. So guilt means that I feel guilty and I need forgiveness. Indignation means that you're guilty, and you should be punished. The two are tied together on the basis that my forgiveness of you is tied together with feeling forgiven myself. A lot of psychology goes towards trying to eliminate artificial guilt. Sure, you need to be liberated from artificial guilt, but you're lucky to be artificially guilty. Most of us are guilty, really, in many ways, and need forgiveness. That's one of the issues. I mean, I've spoken to it in an HIV, in a situation where HIV people are present. If you've got HIV, the chances are very high that you were irresponsible. Now, that does not mean to say that you should be stigmatized, but you did make a mistake. And if you don't admit the mistake, there's no chance of moving beyond it. Now, that's just an example that's particularly emotional and difficult to deal with in the South African context. But it's true that you've got to deal with guilt, but it should not be stigmatizing. It should be reintegrated, that the forgiveness and the dealing with it needs to be reintegrative. We need forgiveness, we need to reintegrate. And I mean, we are leaders in that. I mean, if you look at the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, we've dealt with a lot more than an unprotected sex. So, and then the question of humiliation and fear addressed by others. So the model works in mental illness ways. You can think of things in different ways. But conclusions on motivation here. There are several sources of motivation. Not all are fungible. That's really important. You can't buy love. You can't buy reputation. You can't buy wisdom. You can't buy even pleasure from exercise. There are lots of things you cannot buy that are important for our satisfaction. We know that, but this is just emphasizing it. True happiness, and this is this question of flow, comes when... So if you come across flow, Szentsky Mihaly or whatever, he's done hundreds of thousands of questionnaires of very detailed research of what makes people happy, and he says it's this flow, is when everything comes together. When you're really expert, when you're really committed, when you're really involved, enjoying life, that creates the enjoyment when all these things come together. So happiness, when you can develop and enjoy all the virtues, all these satisfactions, it requires education, the Latin educare, leading out, because the virtue is already there, and it requires intentionality. You actually have to want to do it to get real happiness out of it, as far as he said, the flow people say. Incentives do motivate, but there are different reasons for why they motivate. Firstly, if you have an incentive in the institution, basically in an organization, basically what you're saying is this is important. So there's a cognitive element to that. And it's well known that if you measure something, people will respond to it. So it makes it salient. Don't need any motivation. I was surprised when I was in Scotland and I was with the Scottish Life for 6 weeks just doing an actuarial audit, which they were good enough to allow me to do, to pay for a bit of my sabbatical in 1998. They had set up a admin system where they had very detailed feedback on the standard times for every single administrative activity they did. And they allocated people based on standard times. And the standard times, they've been working with it for 3 or 4 years. Standard times come down all the time. This is the service level agreement type stuff. Standard times for how long the letter took. And it made no difference to salaries. But it improved because it was measured. Okay, so salience is important. Secondly, there are measures of collaboration. We all want to be liked. We like being part of a group. And we would, if the group has particular goals, we want to collaborate with them. So if you set up an incentive and say this is what we're aiming for, people will naturally go for it anyway, regardless of whether that's how sports teams works. Sports teams work. You don't actually have to pay people. And clearly, there are measures of status and identity, and we'll come back to this question of competition just now. And they give an impression of security. So they don't, in many respects, the incentives don't necessarily make any difference in terms of the money that's looked at, and certainly with the high CEO salaries we'll come back to. Most of them can't spend the money, and a number I know have retired in order to give it away. Consequences for prosperity. Does greed motivate? Well, a lot of management research, I don't know if you've come across Hertzberg's work in the 50s, has already shown that intrinsic motivation is more powerful than extrinsic motivation than money. Now we have a more granular view of why this different stuff from neuroscience. And so we might suspect that those who justify greed are mistaken or doing so for their own purposes. So Lord Keynes thought in the 30s said that we needed greed. Although it was terrible, we needed to bring ourselves out of the poverty that existed at the time. And he thought, you need animal spirits, greed, to drive investments. But we're all involved in institutions where you don't need greed to drive. We save pensions to invest. So that he's wrong. Jensen and Meckling, come from Michael Jensen, agency theory. What do they teach at Bits and Cape Town these days? That's the question of aligning the interests of directors with CEOs with the company by giving them share options, etc. They're the beginning of that. They thought that alignment with greed would encourage growth. We now know that it's merely justified greed. Michael Jensen's written, trying to undo the damage he's done. He's written a long paper, 37 things that need to be done to change executive remuneration. The one I like is that directors should stop behaving as if they were employees of the CEO. We also know that overservicing, overproduction, has serious ecological consequences, and that some other means is now required to create jobs. And then Friedman of the Mount Pelerin Society, and Ayn Rand, if you're a fan of hers, thought that self-interest propels free markets. We found that they can be exploitative and reckless if dominated by vested interests. And you've got that wonderful Alan Greenspan's, the Greenspan, what's it called, recanting. Alan Greenspan was actually a disciple of Ayn Rand, and that's the way you talk about the way people that were close to her, because she was quite a dominating personality. He's got that apology in front of the Congress to say, I thought that self-interest would be enough to stop people from being reckless. I was wrong. So, finally, let's just go a little bit about institutions. So, going back to this diagram, and these are the people that I find, the sort of writers that I found useful. Bandura talks about embedded agency, that institutions are, in fact, the embedded result of people's actions. Manka Olson talks about that institutions don't develop spontaneously, they don't just evolve. They need people to act, but he says they're most corrupt. They're very subject to corruption by small groups. So the thing about small groups can influence regulation because they can organize more easily. And if their interests are huge and everyone else's interests are small, they will organize for their own profit. And it's a really useful understanding of what goes on with lobbying in politics. And one of the reasons why one's got to be alert to the possibility that small groups are there manipulating this situation. And you've got it here in South Africa in spades, haven't we? It's what corruption. Small group of people who've managed to sort of, what's the word? State capture. Eleanor Ostrom, wonderful writer on collective action, the only woman to win the Nobel Prize for economics in memory of Alfred Nobel. She talks about collective action. She notes that it can be government or private. That's really quite helpful. So if you see something needs to be done, you don't have to wait. You don't have to lobby. You don't have to wait for government. Very often, private collective organizations can do things. And, you know, we're here in the mutual because in 1846, John Fairbairn and a bunch of well-meaning Cape Town people thought it was time to set up a life insurance company on a mutual basis. And it, one might, well, as I do, those of you who remember, lobbied against demutualization, regret the fact that it is no longer mutual. And one might argue, and I think there's a strong argument to say that they were more trustworthy as a mutual than they are now. Happy to discuss that. As Peter Drucker says, if the decent and idealistic toss power into the gutter snipes pick it up. That's a real challenge for us to say that, and this, because some people are greedy and because small greedy groups can organise, we've got to prevent it from, we've got to work at stopping the corruption of organisations that Olson talks about. So that's in terms of what we need to do institutionally. Personally, we need to develop our own virtue. I've spoken about passion, and David White's passion story. Alistair MacIntyre talks about virtues being created, are only really created in what he calls practices. It means something like the actuarial profession, where you're actually committed in a tradition to a particular contribution to make to society, where intrinsic motivation is important. You want to be a good actuary, and you want to do the job appropriately. You're not doing it for money primarily. That's the consequence that may or may not come. And then that's which is very similar to Csikszentmihalyi's idea of flow. And what I like on this score, some people say, well, it all depends on the institutions. People will behave based on their institutions. But T.S. Eliot has it in his poetry play The Rock, We constantly try to avoid the darkness without and within by dreaming of systems so perfect that we have no need, that there is no need to be good. Apparently, Gandhi repeated it very often, and I think it's really quite important. We have to have personal responsibility as well as a social one. So, just in terms of sort of, what's this called? A thought experiment. Shareholder primacy is a big debate. The idea that companies exist to make profits for shareholders, and that's what we should. That's what we should have, and that's the right way of going about. And the shareholders can be greedy because they can maximise profits. So we ask the question: would you prefer to work for a company where shareholder capital absorbed losses and staff were protected against possible retrenchment and recessions? Or are you happy to work for a company where you will be retrenched as soon as the profits go down so that the dividend can be maintained? That's a contract. Free to choose those contracts one way or the other. Which would you prefer? Anyone prefer to work for a company that retrenches them in recession? Would you want to work for a company where management thought it was their job to motivate, manipulate staff into working overtime and accepting less than their fair pay? Or would you prefer a company that tried to be fair, that wanted to be fair and said it was fair and told you to go home at office 4 or 5 or whenever the time is? Would you prefer to work for an organisation committed to providing for a social purpose, financial security or whatever, while adequately making profits? Would you prefer to work for a company with a flat organisational structure and a collegial atmosphere, or one where the boss is paid astronomical salaries and sees himself as a superior being? I mean, that's a little, what's the word, flippant or supercilious or whatever. But the research does show that if there's a huge gap between the top guy and the next person down, occasionally a woman, the next person down, that they become meaner. Meaner managers is what, you know, you actually become... You become begin to see the people that are working for you as inferior. It works that way. As I asked a group of actuaries in Australia last year, and a quarter of them said it was the question of this high pay was a critical question in governance. The average out of 1 to 10 was 7.6 as being a critical issue, and the regulators, including Apple, who I used to work for, say it's not, ignore it completely. Serious problem. So these, and then free markets. Do you want to participate in markets where the suppliers are always trying to draw you into paying too much for things you do not want? Okay, now let me just be practical here. Back book, front book, that wording used here. Loyalty tax. How many companies, insurance companies impose a loyalty tax here? That's really an actuarial question. Okay, I mean, so I know that in Australia, if you go onto the internet when you renew your short-term insurance, you get a better deal than you've just been offered. Now, actuaries are causing that, they're deciding that, because people are generally too lazy or too trusting to check on you. Is that fair? I think it's manipulative. I do not want to do business with a company that does that. Why should I? Well, the trouble is that everyone's doing it. That's the common problem. But there's no need for that to be the case. And it would be really good to look at ways of doing it differently. How can we create such organisations and markets? It's a challenge. I really would like to see people doing that, saying, we're going to change, we're going to do it differently. And there must be a way of doing it differently. There's no need. It's just like fixed pricing. You don't have to negotiate. You can fix your price and be transparent. And you should be able to make a profit to do that in doing that. We effectively behave like secondhand car salesmen when we try and bluff people into paying more money for the same profit. Maybe, sorry. That's rude to second-hand car salesmen. All right. Restraining greed. We need to. I won't go through this in huge detail. Want to educate in virtue. Literature is one of the ways you do it. Othello, Shakespeare. So Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, whatever, the Bible. We need to introduce ethics back into the social sciences. We need to make people technically literate. Basically, we've got to shame potential perpetrators of greed by making them wise and just, and we've got to encourage potential victims of greed by making them courageous and self-controlled so they're not written over. And then within society, we can look at professionalism, which offers to do things without being greedy. We can look at mutuals. We can look at regulation. We look at actual government provision, which happens in some cases because the industry can't be trusted not to be greedy. Two ways of fixing greed institutionally, preventative and after the event. There's transparency. I put CalPERS there. The investment report, 376 pages, every single investment that they earn, sort of radical transparency. And in Norway, they publish everyone's salary. You can go onto the net and find out what your neighbor's taxable income was, which incidentally has made people unhappier, which is maybe a problem, but maybe it'll come right. Choice, that's the Australian Competition and Something Commission. That's to stop monopolies. This slide didn't get changed. Licensing, we can license, we can standardise or ban things, and their conduct rules, prudential rules that the prudential authorities have, prohibition of conflicts of interest, all to stop people from being greedy. And then after the event, we can punish them for bad faith, we can sue people, and we can restitute unjust gains. So this is partly to say all these things are there to address greed. So greed is a problem and needs to be addressed, and these things need to be strengthened to address them. So someone should have made some... I'm almost at the end, so maybe we should go to the end and then we'll have questions. Competition creates winners and losers. And this is a bit of a problem. Winners feel good because they have elevated levels of testosterone. But losers feel bad. So we do have a bit of a problem if we... And they feel worse if they continue to be subject to the winner. Low levels of testosterone, high levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone. So the challenge is to create organizations where the challenge that's created, the challenge to us, the desire for competition and for identity, is to get the job done excellently and collaboratively. So collaborative organizations ought to be, flattering collaborative organizations ought to, in the long run, be better. TFT and TFTT, tit for tat. So in game theory, tit for tat was found to be superior to any other strategy. So when you collaborated, the point was you collaborate unless the other person doesn't collaborate, and then if she defects, then you punish her. Okay, that makes some sense. But then, after a lot of work, they discovered that a more efficient way in the long run, if you had 1,000 games or many more than that, was tit for two tats. And the tit for two tats basically introduces forgiveness. The first time you're titted, you don't tat. Or sorry, the other way around, you're tatted, you don't tit. The second time you punish. So you limit the punishment. Less punishment creates more efficiency in the long run. But it took a long time to work out that that was the case. So collaboration is better, but it is a long-term thing. Now, obviously, competition in markets gives choice and encourages innovation, and in many cases is a better thing. Just a little thing on greed. Limit excessive pay driven by greed. So hubris. Hubris is the Greeks for strong. It's a Greek word. Classical Greek word, basically it came from that God's made, that God's punished hubris. You've got proud and then you've got hammered. But basically, excessive pay creates hubris. It creates a tournament among subordinates gambling for the big prize. So it creates winners and losers. Great for testosterone, great for the winners, lousy for the losers. Extrinsic motivation drives out intrinsic motivation. There's a lot of research that shows that. Hubris creates overconfidence. It underestimates probabilities and the consequences of failure. So we powerful and overconfident and greedy executives lead their companies into destruction. Lots of examples of that. You get this great leader myth. Encourages focus on short-term results. I mean, I don't know. Do you have it here still? New guys appointed as CEO and the results the following year have got to be better? Yeah? As though you can turn around a company in 6 months or whatever it is? So this leads the responsibility belongs to shareholders, directors, CEOs and regulators to move us away from this this hubristic situation. I just put at the top there from Christopher Marlowe the story about Icarus, who made wax. His father made him wax wings to escape from Sicily or wherever it was, and he flew too high. And it goes till swelled with the cunning of a self-conceit. His waxen wings did mount above his reach, and melting the heavens conspired his overthrow. I'm afraid that's where we end up very often. But this is the question of looking at power. All right, this is summary. Fungibility. Satisfactions are not fungible. So there's four for the testosterone, the oxytocin, serotonin, etc. You can't replace one by the other. They're not like money that could be moved across. But desire is fungible. You can shift your desires from one thing to another, and therefore we need to sublimate, to move our desires so that they're balanced and greater than just money. Virtues are their own reward, the measures of our health. And it just has a consequence for prospect theory. Prospect theory, Danny Kahneman's thing, you've all come across that? The idea that we count losses more seriously than profits. So given the choice of making 100 profit, loss would have to be less than 100. That's regarded as is it illogical? And it is. And I think the reason for it is that losses of reputation or relationships and security are clearly much worse than any gain that we could get of those. You can't get them back again. And that probably means that when we apply that thinking, which is natural, to money, which is our work, we can tend to be too conservative. So I think it's like getting people to invest in the market when they're younger, etc. It's very difficult for them to do that because of this prospect theory. And the point is that money is fungible, even if these satisfactions are not. Some vocational consequences. Institutions matter and can be changed. I didn't finish that. I just repeated my previous. That's all I want to say. Institutions matter and can be changed. And final slide, just some common views. Greed is inherent in all human nature. What I'm suggesting is that temptation is inherent, but it leads to unhealthy addiction. Greed is necessary for economic prosperity. I think no. Prosperity requires creativity, hard work, and collaboration. Greed destroys collaboration for short-term benefit. Common view very often is greed is an emotion that needs to be controlled by reason. I think what comes out of this is greed is an emotional pathology and needs positive emotional development. All inequality, some people regard all inequality as a result of greed. I think that's excessively, inequality can rise by chance, differences in personal effort or by reprehensible exploitation. It's only the exploitation that's wrong. And interestingly, altruism is the opposite of selfishness. No, don't think so. So a lot of people say in order not to be greedy, you should give money away. I think they're different. Justice is the virtue that governs greed. A proper self-love is the true foundation of altruism. Greed is getting money. Altruism is giving it away. There are times when you can give, but it's important to control greed because greed is related to wants. And those wants need to be appropriately desired, need to be appropriately directed. So, there I have it. It's a lot of it. If you want to go home straight away, we'll get to the jinx straight away, I understand. But if you want to make some comments or responses, I'd be grateful for anything that you say now or in any email. You can find me very easily on the web. I'm still working on this. I'll submit it for publication, hopefully, within the next 4 or 5 weeks. Over to you. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, the Quakers had fixed prices, but if you could differentiate in by segments, pricing by different segments, would that be wrong?
Well, the point being that different market segments may be different.
The elasticities may be different. Yeah.
Prime example, your iPhone is produced for a certain cost, but it's sold at different prices across markets based on what the market is prepared to pay.
Okay, I suppose a good question. The question is whether the ability to distinguish, to separate the markets is a collateral power or not. The consequence is, I suppose, that you get, where do you get the cheapest iPhones in the States?
Depends on where you can get them. Customs or that.
When you get the customs, sorry. So, I mean, clearly, if you're trying to avoid tax, it's a problem. And the question is how you're distinguishing, how you're drawing the boundaries between the markets. If there's deception involved or an unfair power, I think it is unfair. Maybe that's a complicated question, if in fact there is deception or if the use of the power is unfair. In some respects, yeah, I mean, would it be better to eliminate the distinctions in the market, I think, is the question. And if it would be, then maybe we should work for eliminating those differences in the market to make it fairer and more effective. Because certainly having smaller markets is not efficient.
They're asking if I can tie you to the podium.
Sorry, you should have said so earlier.
Anthony, I want to ask, is there a player that's more important than another in this market? So given that greed and virtue coexist in the market, What lubricates and drives the market? Because the suppliers of capital are the ones who ultimately devote capital to enterprise. So does this eventually end up in how you control shareholder greed? And is there sort of a pull to those who have most capital are most greedy? Because they're most ruthless.
Look, there may be something on that score. Can I talk into this mic?
I think so, yeah.
There may be something in that score, but I think, I mean, the psychology is that the entrepreneurs are not greedy. I mean, I don't think, you know, even the guys that are really, if you look at the well-known people, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, the Amazon.com guy, you know, would you, Jeff Bezos, would you say they were driven by greed? It's difficult to say that. I mean, they were lucky. They were certainly energetic. They certainly, I mean, certainly in the case of Microsoft, were very happy to manipulate in terms of pushing prices up as much as possible. But, you know, I mean, the guy's given it all away. So greed wasn't the primary motivation of what he was doing. And I mean, the people, you know, who do you know that is creative, that's greedy? I don't know anyone. They're different. They're different motivations, really. The greedy guy. I won't say that again. I'm about to be rude to someone, to groups of people, but I think the people allocate their capital to the place which is most profitable, and that's quite acceptable. But you know, at the moment we're rolling in capital internationally. Interest rates are negative in most places. It shouldn't be difficult to find capital. We may be institutional structures that need to be improved to make it easier to be innovative, but it seems to be working fairly well. But it remains a challenge for the institutions which we represent in many cases to make sure that we are providing capital to places that are where it can be usefully applied. But you know, that's our job. Well, you know, the job of our institutions.
Anthony, thanks very much for the presentation. The Royal Commission in Australia, there were certain kind of practices in the financial services sector there that came under heavy criticism. What were some of the practices that kind of stood out for you, and how do you see that in the context of this framework?
So the ones that stood out for me were the pressured selling. So I'm afraid some produced by companies associated with South African entrepreneurs in Australia, the one perhaps the worst was where a Down syndrome guy ended up spending a chunk of his pension on a life insurance policy that he didn't need. There's been a lot of compensation, as I think here, or certainly in this UK, for policies sold associated credit life, where the guys were sold at unemployment insurance and they couldn't possibly claim on it because they were students and didn't have jobs. So that sort of heavy stuff. I mean, a lot of money's been paid back. I mean, I was by billions of dollars are now being paid back to people for mis-selling of various sorts. I'm less concerned with, which sounds the shocking type stuff with people were charged by insurance companies for, dead people were charged for services, because I think they probably would have got compensated if they'd been not, if that probably would have been undone at some point. And there have been some instances where the regulator have taken companies to court, and based on what came out of the Royal Commission, and the courts have found in the company's favour, and I think in most cases that was right. But so the stuff that did come out, all that came out of the Royal Commission, which was very circumscribed in what it could investigate, only things that the companies reported to having done wrong were actually dealt with in public. So they were really naughty things. Mis-selling in most of the case. Overpricing didn't even come into it. And, this question of the loyalty tax, I think, is one that's going to come out over the next little while. We're going to move towards fee-for-service for advice. So conflicted advice and salesmanship of people financial advisors effectively putting you into products that pay huge commissions will be reduced. And Australia is pretty much ahead on that particular score. We haven't had front-end loaded life insurance policies for 30 years. And now they're squeezing the trail commissions that people have been earning. So we've made some progress. My real concern and why I've really got involved here is that there's been this huge criticism of the financial sector, and I think the financial sector just bunkered down and hoped it'll blow over and they can go back to their old wicked ways at a later stage. And I think this is an opportunity to try and change. Margaret?
Inadequate claims underwriting up front, where actuaries in the short-term space have more and more sophisticated risk models, And then the ultimate claims underwriting is very clumsy with a lot of repudiated claims. It's my impression that Huey got into a lot of trouble in Australia on that score.
I can't speak, sorry, this is, you get repudiated claims. I can't speak for about that. I don't know how much was happening. There certainly was unhappiness on claims, much on the disability side. But frankly, the life insurance industry has been, you know, just walking like, you know, dead men in that space. I mean, I don't think, you know, they were offering disability insurance to people that could claim immediately. And I mean, I've been told that companies are now paying claims. If people want to claim, they can have it. They're not repudiating at all because they're scared of the backlash. And that demonstrates that they actually hadn't thought about it in the first place, because what they should have been doing is saying, this, we have thought about it. We can't pay claims to everyone. And this is but we are confident that what we're doing is fair. And the fact of the matter that they weren't being fair. So, they've lost the ability to say no for the moment.
Can you hear me, Anthony?
Yes, I can.
Hi, it's Simon Lowe. How are you?
Hi, Simon.
Good. You take as your starting point that greed is bad. The question to the topic was, is greed good for business? And I'm not sure we've actually addressed that prior question. I mean, there are lots of examples of abuse, but what is wrong with greed itself? Is it because it's unfair? And that might be okay if you're using an economic rent argument, because it's been well proven that economic rents are bad. But if it's not an economic rent argument, then what is the argument that greed is bad? I'm finding I'm missing that point. If it's because it's unfair, then you might need to explore a little bit about what is fairness exactly. Also looking at you, I think you were trying to relate greed with desire. So if it's misplaced desire, then is desire wrong itself? And do we have a sense of like good greed or bad greed? So I think maybe exploring a little bit about the nature of greed itself before then addressing how to address the problem of greed.
Can we turn that mic? All right. I think the point is that is greed good? Well, I think it's very clear that economic rents and manipulative pricing create benefits for one party and not another, and that's bad. And the argument that is very often made by economists and business people is, in fact, although that is bad, we have to accept that. This is what Keynes says anyway. We have to accept that because the benefits of economic motivation are such that people motivated by greed create economic growth, and the economic growth has huge benefits to society. The point of the sort of mind map is to say that our motivations are not related. Our motivations are fungible. They do not come just from money or from narrow views of self-interest. We are motivated by dopamine, which leads to other satisfactions, esteem, family, relationships, creativity, religious, etc. So that the view that there are benefits from greed in the economy are actually misplaced. They don't come from self-interest. They don't come from greed for money. They don't come from people do not invest because they're animal spirits and they're greedy. They come from a number of different other reasons why people do economic things. So the greed is the actual idea that greed is a good thing for business is actually misplaced and a misunderstanding of motivation. And yes, and that is the point, that greed is, there are different types of motivation and desire. In their appropriate place, they're good, but when they turn into addictions, where you're not looking for actual satisfactions, but you're actually motivated by you're just motivated to keep on doing things for the gambling, to keep on gambling for the sake of the gamble, you're then misplaced. That's then misplaced desire. Yeah. Thanks.
No more questions from Joburg side.
Okay. Anthony, thank you very much. Anthony is a winner of the, or a holder of the Murray Medal, which is society's most prestigious award. It is made rarely. I think it's made 18 times thus far. And I think you can see why. Thank you very much for being here. Refreshments on this side tonight. There's a small little something just to say thank you.
Thank you very much.
And very good to have you with us. Hope to see you back soon.
Thank you so much, Ron. Thank you. Thanks, Ray.